It's the morning show. I'm Shereen Seward. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the story of the man behind an action hero.
You know the action movie character John Wick, the assassin who avenges the death of his dog? Well, did you know the real John Wick lives in Wisconsin? Matt Geiger introduces us to him.
I'm sitting in a roadside diner in Reno when John Wick walks through the door. The John Wick. The John Wick you may be better acquainted with is an assassin in a black suit with matching hair and beard. Over the course of three movies, he has killed somewhere in the neighborhood of 300 bad guys. Played by an earnest Keanu Reeves, he uses a pencil and a dusty book of Russian fairy tales, among other things, as lethal weapons.
People keep asking if I'm back, and I haven't really had an answer. But now, yeah, I'm thinking I'm back.
Of course, on the other hand...
Back in the diner... The man next to me is 96, deaf, and uses a walker to get around. He eats here 6 days a week, and shortly after he arrives, a tall glass of cold milk and a bowl brimming with fruit are placed on the table in front of him. Wick has lived in Mazamani since 1955. He wears a wedding ring in remembrance of Helen, the woman he married in 1947. How did this John Wick in the movie John Wick come to share a name? The answer is screenwriter Derek Kolstad, who happens to be the real John Wick's grandson.
And he wrote a movie called Scorn. And in that movie, he named the assassin John Wick for his grandfather, and the assassin's wife, Helen, for his grandmother. It was Keanu Reeves who, in a desire to create a series of movies, who removed the name Scorn and gave it the name John Wick.
So what does he think of the movies that bear his name and have racked up more than $500 million at the global box office?
No, I haven't seen them. And Derek knows I haven't seen them. I don't go to movies because I can't hear them. I don't have television because I can't hear it.
Despite not seeing or hearing them, he has enjoyed their success.
Oh, yeah. That's been fun. I've enjoyed that. Yeah.
In the movies, Wick fights against villains who killed a puppy that was a gift from his recently deceased wife.
When Ellen died, I lost everything. Until that dog arrived on my doorstep. And your son took that from me.
As I sit here with Mr. Wick, it occurs to me just how important the real Helen, who died 5 years ago, is. The real John Wick grew up on a farm, joined the U.S. Navy, and had a long career in construction. He proudly points out the size of his family, his clan, as he calls them, which includes 58 people. Despite all the fun and outlandish aesthetics and action of the films, perhaps what makes these stories so popular is how they capture the bond between two people. When someone we love is taken in real life, usually simply by time rather than assassins, we are left to go on without them. But we refuse. We hold on, and in our memories, in the stories we tell, we keep them here in our world just a little longer.
Over the years, Helen and I often went into Madison to eat and go to a movie. Just the two of us, not with the kids.
John Wick's grandson told a story that's been seen and heard by millions of people. Here in Grandma Mary's diner, surrounded by clattering dishes and far from Hollywood, the original John Wick tells his own story. Not of the movies that bear his name, but of the films he used to see all those years ago, and the person with whom he saw them.
Writer Matt Geiger brought us that story on the real John Wick. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It's the morning show. I'm Shireen Seward, in for Kate Archer-Kent. Disasters, from extreme weather events to public health crises, are a risk for all people in the United States, but some segments of the population are more vulnerable than others to the consequences. How can local officials plan for emergencies in a way that mitigates the impact of disasters for the people most at risk? Join in this discussion on a new study that found gaps in the way emergency plans work in communities across Wisconsin. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Samantha Larson is an assistant professor of public administration at the University of Wisconsin-Oshkosh. She is deputy director of the Whitburn Center for Governance and Policy Research and has been studying disaster response on a local and national level for more than a decade. Sam, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Shireen. Good morning, and thanks for having me.
The Whitburn Center's new study examines socially vulnerable populations and how counties include them in their emergency response plans. What did you find?
Yeah, so I think a number of things, but I'll focus on one of the main pieces that really came out of this study, and that is that socially vulnerable groups, and we looked at just four, there are many others, but that includes folks who are elderly, people with disabilities, those who are low income, and people with limited English proficiency, really don't show up very much when we're looking at planning documents that are pretty common in many counties, including emergency operation plans and hazard mitigation plans. And so what we looked at in the study, and this was a joint effort with students in the Master of Public Administration program here at UW-Oshkosh, really looked at how we can do a better job of engaging those types of folks in the planning efforts.
What factors make these groups of people more likely to suffer from a disaster? What is it about their situations that leads to that?
Yeah, so it's a great question. And the resource that I always go to really help me understand this is the Social Vulnerability Index, which is created by the CDC. So as you mentioned, right, we're looking at folks who have vulnerabilities to whether it's, you know, extreme weather events or, you know, disease outbreaks like COVID-19. These are the folks who don't necessarily have the resources really to prepare or recover from events like this. And that looks like things such as, you know, folks who don't have a vehicle. So if you aren't able to evacuate, if there is water coming up in your neighborhood, that's an issue, right? Also, there are things within the index that help us think about folks who maybe not be as mobile. So household composition is another factor. Homes with people who are, you know, age 65 or above, or homes with children who are, you know, older than 5 with a disability. Those types of factors make it more difficult to address crises in certain ways. And then the other side of it is in the recovery phase, right? So if we think about not just when a disaster strikes, but after the fact, you know, folks who are below the poverty line or are unemployed or are low income aren't able to have the same types of resources as other folks who may be able to, you know, go for 1 month or more if some kind of financial issue comes up where they're not able to make it to work or things like that.
Why do you think that some of the more socially vulnerable people are left out of emergency response plans? What caused that?
Yeah, so I think, you know, a big part of this, and as I've been looking at this over time, it's really the difficulty, right, of on one side, engaging those types of folks in the planning process. And I really say this from a place of knowing that, you know, meetings may be held, there may be a strong effort by, you know, professionals in this area to bring people in, but meetings are held and folks don't show up. And I've seen that, you know, for over a decade. And so that part of it's really difficult. The other piece of it in emergency management, you know, just thinking about this from an individual level, unless folks have water coming in their basement, or unless, you know, there's no air conditioning in our home or our apartment, and there's a heat wave, we don't really prepare for things like this until they're at our front door or until they're really happening to us. And so, sure. you know, historically, it's been a really reactive area. But as these types of events become stronger, storms become stronger, heat becomes more intense, it's really important for us on a broad level, and I think a community level, to be able to come together and think about how we can work together and do better to help these types of folks get the resources and information and access that they need to stay safe when these types of events happen.
Sam Larson is the deputy director of the Whitburn Center for Governance and Policy Research. The center released a study in August showing how emergency response plans can better support socially vulnerable populations. Join in, 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Shereen Seward. Responding to disaster situations has a range of challenges for local officials, especially when it comes to reaching the people who are impacted the most. Join in with your thoughts and questions, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sam Larson has been studying disaster response on a local and national level for more than a decade. She is assistant professor at UW Oshkosh and the deputy director of the Whitburn Center for Governance and Policy Research. The center has a new study on how to better protect vulnerable populations during and after a disaster. Sam is with us for about 10 more minutes. The study outlines how to better support socially vulnerable people during disasters. Sam, one way is to know the population before a disaster strikes, and the study specifically points to the city of Green Bay as an example. Can you explain what you found?
Sure. So, you know, in Green Bay, and we focused again at the county level, so in Brown County, but of all of the counties that we looked at, we were really interested in Green Bay because, or I should say Brown County, because they have a few kind of data points that make them of interest. One is if we look at their social vulnerability level, they have a moderate social vulnerability level, and this ranges from, you know, low to high. So it's on the higher side for compared to the other counties that we looked at. They also have a resiliency score that we looked at. And that's the other really important piece when we're talking about vulnerability. We also need to look at what types of systems are in place to ensure or, you know, determine whether or not the ability to respond will really be strong, or if we need to develop that. And so their resiliency is at about a medium high level. So they also have a fair amount of resiliency in place. But the key piece within Brown County that we, you know, want to dig into a bit further is thinking about groups such as those with limited English proficiency. So in Brown County, we looked at the data there, and it's higher than the state of Wisconsin on average. So it's a higher level there. They have a higher proportion of people of color, which also impacts vulnerability. And then, folks who are living with disabilities as well. And the population that's 65 or older. And so those are kind of the key pieces that are important. But what's even greater is that the index, I mentioned, you know, we have a reading at the county level, but it also provides census tract level readings on these types of groups. And what we're seeing in Brown County is downtown Green Bay specifically has a much higher level of vulnerability than the surrounding area. So that data can be used to really focus in efforts on folks living and working in that area, and specifically living in that area, and starting to think about how we can engage those groups to a higher level.
Sam, we will go to the phone with Lexi from Fond du Lac. Hi, Lexi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. And hi, Sam, this is Lexi. It's good to hear your voice. Hey, I'm just wondering what your study entails for climate change specifically and for Indigenous communities in Wisconsin. And I'm sorry if you talked about that already and I missed it, but those two things specifically I was wondering about.
Thanks, Lexi. Sam?
Yeah, happy to discuss that. So the focus on climate change, you know, what we're really starting to get at here is the idea of climate resiliency. And so that's kind of the overarching idea behind this study and motivation for it. Because what we're seeing, and you know, I'm not a specialist on the environmental side. I'm starting to work with more and more folks who are and have in the past. But right, what we're seeing in specifically East Central Wisconsin, the impacts of climate change will be more extreme heat and more intense thunderstorms, which can lead to flooding. And so those are the types of issues that we want to really focus on. The second piece, your question about looking at Indigenous communities. So we also brought that into this study and looked at, from a demographic perspective, right, where Indigenous communities are living. And that certainly is incorporated into the index, because one of the kind of higher risk and higher factors for vulnerability are Indigenous communities, BIPOC communities. And so I'm going to kind of step outside of our study, but look at the broader state of Wisconsin. If you look at vulnerability, the counties with the highest level of vulnerability in the state are Milwaukee County and Menominee County, largely because of higher proportions of people of color throughout Milwaukee County. And then, of course, the higher proportion of the Indigenous community in Menominee County. And so those are the areas as well, beyond this study, but hopefully in the next steps of the work that we're doing, where we want to expand our scope and look at the types of resiliency measures that are happening there to try to, you know, protect those folks to a higher extent and ensure that we're working with those communities in doing so.
We're talking about the way socially vulnerable populations are negatively impacted by disasters and the ways local government can mitigate those impacts. Sam Larson has been studying disaster response on a local and national level for more than a decade. She is deputy director of the Whitburn Center for Governance and Policy Research. We only have about 2 minutes left in our time together, but I want to go to the phone again. We have Lester from Milwaukee. Hi, Lester.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. And thank you for coming on to the program this morning. What a critical topic that we all need to be discussing. I just got a quick question for you. Why or where is the component for the innovation approach to address some of these issues at this critical time, to address energy and food crisis for the people of color, children? I think it affects just not only people of color, but everyone when it floods, when it gets heat, people, indigenous people. I think that we all need to come together and sit down at the table and have funding for some innovation that address some of these critical issues at this time. Thank you.
Lester, thank you. Sam, what about the innovation component?
Yeah, it's such a fantastic question. And I'm really happy, Lester, that you brought up the community aspect of this. So on a national level, there's this framework that's called the whole community approach. And that's through the Federal Emergency Management Association, or FEMA. And that's the key piece, I think, that we need to be thinking about. Is this takes not just folks who are, you know, working in the public sector, not just emergency management folks. And that's something that we here at UW Oshkosh, and we have a sustainability institute here on campus, we're focusing on how to develop a climate resilience plan, and we're part of this initiative. But the key piece is working in partnership. We need to bring on board businesses, residents, you know, public officials, and universities. That's the key thing. There are a lot of resources at universities across the state. And so we want to make sure that we can tap into those resources. And I should say, as a faculty member here, be one of those resources to think through more innovative approaches, because it's really important. Lester brought up the energy piece of this, right? We need to start thinking forward on, you know, just this summer here in Oshkosh, we had a large thunderstorm and over 10,000 people were out of power for something like 8 hours. And so, and that can, you know, exacerbate pretty quickly. So we need to start thinking about what happens when that type of event occurs. And I think it's going to take a community level approach to thinking about this.
Sam, just briefly, in 15 seconds, what is the number one thing that local governments could do to improve their response?
Yeah, there's a continuum of engagement, 5 different levels. And I think the key piece is moving from just informing folks by, you know, putting out Facebook posts and things like that to inviting people in and meeting up with them to get input on how we can best serve needs when we are experiencing these types of events. For instance, right?
Sure. Thank you. I'm sorry. That's all the time we have. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Sam Larson, an assistant professor of public administration at the University of Wisconsin-Oshkosh, deputy director of the Whitburn Center for Governance and Policy Research. You can find the study released this month at wpr.org/mornings. Up ahead, we speak with a UW-Eau Claire researcher who looked at ways the UW system, can improve emergency preparedness during a public health emergency. Join in 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. News update is next on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Shereen Seward in for Kate Archer Kent. Wisconsin universities have their own unique requirements when it comes to emergency response plans. Those rules were put to the test during the COVID-19 public health crisis, but what role can partnerships play? And is there a blueprint to improve the response to a future public health crisis? Join in this discussion, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Matthew Jewell is an associate professor of materials science and biomedical engineering at UW-Eau Claire. Matt, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Shereen. Great to be with you again.
Before we get to the study's findings, I'm curious to get your take on this. Why should the UW system be considered a resource during public health emergencies? What's the basis for that?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And I think two important answers to that. The first is that within UW system, we have this idea called the Wisconsin idea, which is simply that the boundaries of the university should be the boundaries of the state, that the work we do at public universities in Wisconsin should benefit the entire state. And so it's natural and important, and as we do our research and our outreach, that we'd be thinking about how is this going to benefit our community. And so also in times of crisis, we see it as part of our mission and our job to think about how can the work we do on campus be benefiting the state overall, the communities that we live in and have the campuses in. And then the second thing I would say is that, frankly, there's a lot of expertise at the UW system campuses. There are a lot of experts in all kinds of things that were important during the pandemic, wastewater and groundwater testing and public administration and communication and all sorts of things that in a crisis should be put to use to benefit everyone and not just our campus communities. So for both those reasons, we wanted to kind of sit down and evaluate how well did we do during the last pandemic here, during the crisis we just went through. And hopefully we don't see another event like that in the near future. But when the next crisis does come, how can we maybe be a little bit more thoughtful and intentional about making sure that we're using those resources to their best effect everywhere in the state?
What are the emergency planning requirements for Wisconsin universities? Take us through that a little bit.
Well, I think especially pre-pandemic, they varied a great deal. I would say different campuses had very different levels of emergency preparedness, different types of plans in place for how they're going to handle different scenarios. Of course, you can't predict something like the pandemic. Different emergencies might look like chemical spills, you know, active shooter situations, or a health emergency. And so you can't have a sort of uniform response to everything. But what you can have are some of the people in place, some of the resources in place to make sure that you can respond effectively and quickly when the time comes. And importantly, as I'm sure we'll talk about here further, importantly, having the relationships existing with some of those community partners so that those can be activated and utilized. And that was a key finding of our study, that to the extent that UW system schools and community partners worked well together during the pandemic, it was primarily when there were existing relationships. There was already some kind of collaboration established. There was already some kind of back and forth. And then people knew each other well enough and trusted each other well enough and understood, you know, the value that the university could provide the community or vice versa, that then those things really were effective. And where those relationships didn't exist beforehand, frankly, there wasn't a lot of collaboration. There are lots of examples of UW system resources going unused during the pandemic in different communities around the state because there just weren't those existing ties.
We're talking about how universities across the state respond to public health emergencies and the ways that the response can be improved in the future. UW Eau Claire Professor Matt Jewell is a co-author of a new report, Implementing the Wisconsin Idea During Crisis. Your colleague interviewed UW system staff about their experiences during this period. How do the staff feel that the U.S. system responded to the pandemic?
Yeah, I think, first, a lot of great stories came out of that. Lots of good examples of UW system schools very rapidly and nimbly standing up vaccination and testing sites all over the state, some of those for campus personnel and some for entire communities. Great examples of people making PPE. In fact, this is what got me into this study in the first place, is one of my colleagues here at UW Eau Claire, as the rest of us all went work from home in March of 2020. He instead sat alone in a lab here on campus and was 3D printing visors for face masks for local hospital personnel. And there are other examples of that as well around the state that we detail in the report. And so it's examples like that that kind of got us interested in this in the first place of where else is this happening. So there are a lot of good examples of that happening. And then also some real challenges. Lots of UW schools reported, as you can imagine, feeling like there was a lack of resources and personnel, or we're not staffed up to handle large emergencies on a short-term basis. Was difficult to meet sometimes campus needs and needs in the community. And of course, the environment changed so rapidly, hard to be nimble and stay on top of things. And also maybe also challenges with communication, of being able to get out the necessary information at the right time. So all those things were a challenge for the campuses and their community partners.
You interviewed staff at healthcare systems throughout the state, and I'm curious what response strategies hospital staff found most effective.
Yeah, this was really interesting for me. I did indeed have a chance to go around and talk with a number of hospital systems around the state, larger systems and some smaller ones as well in rural areas. And so it was very interesting to hear their response. And I'll just say maybe to your listeners, if you know a doctor or a nurse or a hospital administrator or worker, please take them out for lunch and sit them down and ask them to talk through their experience over the last couple of years when they're emotionally ready to do that. Very interesting to hear all the things that they've been through. Again, a lot of creativity and nimbleness reported there. A lot of very creative uses of hospital space, of modifying HVAC systems, of even building bed frames with 2x4 lumber to handle influxes of patients. Good examples of competitors within the healthcare industry, setting aside those competitive impulses and working together to get things out. Of course, standing up again, testing vaccination sites, helping out public health departments. So a lot of real positives there. And then as well, just like with UW system, a lot of challenges. Some hospitals reported struggling to sort of convince their communities that this was a real public health crisis that needed a stronger response. A real challenge with sharing and aggregating and using all the data that came out of COVID-19, all of the information about who was sick and how badly and how long they were in the hospital and all these things that are really important for managing the public health crisis. Very difficult to get that and use that in a good way. Challenges with nursing homes, who of course had their own challenges during COVID-19, but sometimes those nursing homes didn't want to accept a patient back who was COVID positive, and so then the hospitals became sort of the quarantine site of last resort. And at one point, the Wisconsin Hospital Association estimated that 700 beds, which is almost 5% of our total hospital capacity in Wisconsin, was being used just by patients who were essentially just in quarantine and recovering and didn't need a hospital level of care, but had to do that anyway. And just one more I'll add. Mm-hmm. Hospitals really reported that they struggled sometimes to deal with and respond to misinformation in the community, information that people were bringing to them that was just not accurate about the health crisis. Mm-hmm. And the health situation. And some doctors and nurses feeling overwhelmed or like, this is not our job, or we're not well trained to sort of combat this, but it was there and had to sort of deal with it in the moment.
You also found that hospitals and government regulators worked together to waive or relax regulations to respond more quickly to the pandemic. Can you give some examples of that?
Yes. So there are many examples around, for example, PPE requirements, staffing requirements in hospitals, what sort of data needs to be reported out about patients, things that can be very time consuming. And so hospitals at different points asked for some flexibility on those regulations. And in general, as you say, we found that regulators were quite receptive and willing to provide some flexibility there. And a really interesting question now going forward, and a point for some UW system collaboration, is which of those flexibilities should maybe be continued? Which of those flexibilities should be maintained and actually would be, you know, healthier approaches in the long run versus which should be rolled back and you know, return to sort of a status quo environment? And that'd be a great place for UW system to get involved in terms of doing some of the underlying research, examining the long-term health outcomes of making those changes, would be a great avenue for some collaboration.
Circling back to the UW system, what role does the system play in monitoring the spread of COVID-19?
Yeah, we did not, on a statewide basis, have an official roles. You know, we were not a state agency that had this as a primary directive, but got very involved on two bases. First of all, when you think about the UW system communities around the state, a number of them are modest-sized communities. And the UW system school that's there, whether that's UW Platteville or UW Stout in Menominee or take your pick, a lot of times that campus community is a pretty significant fraction, or it's a large population base in the community, meaning that the data that campuses were able to generate and as well as the response they were able to make, the vaccinations and testing they were able to do, represented a significant fraction of the community response. So that's an important part here too, just to recognize that in a lot of communities, especially as you get outside Madison and Milwaukee, UW system schools are an important community partner. And so the data they generate and what they learn about COVID-19 is going to be important for their communities.
Matt,
and then the other thing to be said there is that we also at UW system schools have a lot of local experts who understand groundwater monitoring, air quality monitoring, these sort of things. And of course, that expertise also exists in public health departments and things like that around the state. But in several cases, it was helpful for UW system faculty personnel to be able to come alongside and assist or help scale up some of those things so that there could be more robust examples of that happening. I think probably you're well aware that this wastewater monitoring was one, you know, interesting thing that came out of COVID-19 that in fact, it could be detected in the wastewater often before it was really evident that it was in the population. And so mm-hmm. there are examples mm-hmm. of UW system schools helping to scale up those sort of efforts.
Yeah, very interesting. Matt Jewell is an associate professor of materials science and biomedical engineering at UW Eau Claire. Join in 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Shereen Seward. We continue our discussion on a report that examines the response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Join in on this discussion on potential ways to improve the crisis response in the future. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Matt Jewell is an associate professor of materials science and biomedical engineering at UW Eau Claire. Matt, you say UW campuses and healthcare systems relied on existing partnerships in their response to the pandemic. When you look at it now, how can those partnerships be improved when it comes to addressing a future public health crisis?
Yeah, that's a really important question, Shereen, and really was one of the core recommendations that came out of our report. And just to give a little context, it's important to recognize that we, meaning UW system, but also the state of Wisconsin, we can't be on a sort of hair trigger alert level for the next crisis at all times. In other words, at some level, there's always going to have to be some sort of scale up or response to something after it happens. At the same time, what can we do to be better prepared now and in a sustainable way, in a way that's you know, going to allow us to have resources in place for years. And we really think that a key thing there are these relationships between the UW System schools and the various community partners that we rely on. So as an example, when we talk about things like wastewater or air quality monitoring, to the extent that individual faculty members, departments, or schools can establish those relationships with their municipal partners and have ongoing research projects, which of course are part of our everyday work that we do here at the university, to work with students and do that kind of research, to the extent that we can have those projects ongoing during sort of regular times, if you like, then that relationship and that capability and that understanding of the capabilities of the UW System school, they're there and can be activated more easily. So that's a really important thing we try to think about, is how can we get those sort of potential emergency response resources into what is just sort of the normal workflow of university life and community life. And similarly, here at UW-Eau Claire, we saw a really nice example with our partnership with Mayo Clinic Health System, which is here in Eau Claire and through Western Wisconsin. And there's real resources and incentives for UW-Eau Claire faculty members to develop research projects and research collaborations with Mayo Clinic doctors and researchers there. And that, again, then allows for these sort of established relationships to be there so that they can be utilized. I think one of our interviewees said something along the lines of, you don't want to be handing out business cards in an emergency. And the point is you have to sort of know who you can turn to before the fact, and that helps out a great deal. A second thing I would add is that we also found it really helps to have some visible and outward-facing outreach centers at the schools around the state. So here at UW-Eau Claire, we have the Material Science and Engineering Center, which does a great deal of industrial outreach, does testing and works with companies around the region. Over at Oshkosh, they have the Environmental Research and Innovation Center, which does a lot of ongoing work with companies and organizations in the Fox Valley there. And they were able then to scale it up and utilize that during COVID. And down at Madison, there's institutes like the Granger Center, the Granger Engineering Center, that was able to print PPE and help with needs in that area. And so having those centers, which are already community-facing, which already have a community-focused mission, those then become natural collection points for making sure that university resources are getting disseminated and used by the community during a time of crisis.
You recommend that universities create a searchable database of employees and their skill sets. And I like what you said, you don't want to be handing out a business card in the middle of an emergency like this. But if other agencies like hospitals or local governments even would want to create a searchable database, do you see a benefit in that?
Yes, absolutely. And it was interesting we just did a very brief sort of internet survey of the different UW System schools, and we won't name any names here on the air, but some did a much better job of this than others. Some already have those sort of databases or indexes available where you can essentially type in a need or a specialty and you see what resources the campus has, and others did not do that as well. So within UW System, for sure, we could do a better job of that. And as you say, at the community level too, different hospital systems, for example, are very different and have very different in-house capabilities. And so what a hospital in one community might have available in terms of expertise and resources might look very different from another's. So to the extent that we can get some of that online and indexed and available for easy searching, then yes, of course, that's going to be a helpful thing.
We're talking about tangible ways that state colleges and healthcare systems can improve crisis response with reflections on the COVID-19 pandemic. UW-Eau Claire Professor Matt Jewell is an author of a new report, Implementing the Wisconsin Idea During Crises. Before the pandemic, Matt, how much did universities know about the weaknesses in their response plans? Were they aware that there were gaps?
I think probably varies by campus. Certain campuses, including I think locally here in Eau Claire, there's a relatively strong backbone of emergency preparedness in terms of sort of tabletop exercises with local emergency officials and campus personnel in place who have the responsibility of helping the campus to respond to an emergency. So a lot of those things were in place. But it's also true, and I think everyone around the state would recognize that COVID-19 was an extraordinary emergency and a very different sort of emergency situation from what a lot of people might expect a community to go through. And so it certainly stress tested the system in a significant way. So I think every community and every UW system school would acknowledge that there are ways to be better prepared.
Hindsight's 2020, right? How much of the responses could have been known ahead of time?
Yeah, I think certain things in terms of having resources in place or having better financial flexibility, let's say, to make emergency purchases, there are things like that that we could have probably known in advance. Other things I think would have been difficult to predict. I mentioned before about the hospitals struggling with sort of how to deal with some of the misinformation they would hear from people in their community. And I think that's the sort of thing that's actually quite difficult to think about ahead of time or know exactly how that's going to manifest itself and how to respond to it. So there's always going to be some element of having to respond on the fly and utilize what's sort of at your disposal. But we can, I think every campus and every community around the state can take some time to reflect on sort of where they are and what are sustainable things that they can be doing to prepare better.
How urgent is it that hospitals be preparing for another health crisis? And should it be urgent? Is this something that is going to happen in the future? Or are we just thinking maybe it might?
Well, I don't know. I'm not a medical expert. I don't know how likely it is that we will continue to see whether it's waves of COVID-19 or other new health emergencies. What I would say is that it's clear that health systems are still under a great deal of stress from the existing crisis we just went through. There's still a lot of burnout, a lot of staffing challenges, for example. So I think hospitals are still very much in recovery mode from what I can tell. So I think this sort of project of having a more robust ecosystem, let's call it, of resources in place to respond to the next emergency, I think that's going to be a long-term project. I think they already, I'm sure, have some sense of a few things they can do better, but I think it's a project of years and not months to put some of these things in place.
Matt, I want to thank you for joining us and sharing your research with us today.
Yeah, thank you, Shireen. Appreciated it, and take care.
You too. Matt Jewell is an associate professor of materials science and biomedical engineering at UW-Eau Claire. Earlier, we spoke with Sam Larson, deputy director of the Whitburn Center for Governance and Policy Research at UW-Oshkosh. The center has a new study examining how local governments can better support the socially vulnerable during disasters. Both reports can be found on our program page, WPR.org/mornings. I'm Shireen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.